I'm really thrilled to be able to use the platform of the Southeast Asia seminar today to join with my colleagues in presenting some work from one of our ongoing projects that's been going on for about a year and a half, and will run through July. We'll talk a little bit about the broader framing of this project over the course of our specific discussion today, but this is very much work in progress. And so we're really eager to kind of share some of this empirical stuff, some of the preliminary analysis, and get some feedback on it as well. you've heard from me, and my colleague Dr. Makhe Mamaji was formerly the Aung San Suu Kyi Gender Research Fellow at Lady Margaret Hall, and our colleague Athane is a research fellow on this ESRC-funded project through the Department of Politics and International Relations. And we're also presenting on behalf of our other colleague, Saw Aung Thaam Wei, who is Burma-based and was here a few weeks ago and is now sort of back as our eyes and ears in the field. I should say before we get started here that, as often happens, we've, over the course of writing things up and doing this work, we've shifted the title a bit. So this was originally advertised as Myanmar's Buddhist National, quote-unquote, Buddhist Nationalist Movement, A Challenge to Religious Authorities. And we've sort of softened it and complicated it in other ways. And so what we want to present here, we're tentatively titling, is Myanmar's quote-unquote Buddhist nationalist movement also a religious reform movement? The ambivalent relationship of Mabatha and monastic authorities. So since 2012, Myanmar's broader political transition has taken place alongside a phenomenon that many have described as a rise in quote-unquote Buddhist nationalism. Rioting and fighting occurred between Buddhists and Muslims in several prominent instances across the country between 2012 and 2014, and then again since 2016. Set against an increase in public anti-Muslim rhetoric, as well as the adoption of allegedly discriminatory laws in 2015. The most visible group in this field over the past few years has been Mabatha, and that's their Burmese acronym. We usually translate it in English as the Organization for the Protection of Race and Religion. Mabatha was renamed the Buddha Dhamma Parahita Foundation in June 2017. We'll kind of come back to that. But we're going to use Mabatha in this talk as a kind of shorthand for this organization that is, you know, is kind of in a transitional process. Partly because it's the acronym that people are more familiar with, and we don't want to throw out these new terms. But I will say that part of our larger project is to better understand and kind of disaggregate this broad movement, even within a single organization like Mabatha. While an anti-Muslim orientation is undoubtedly part of what motivates Mabatha, understanding it solely in this way cannot adequately explain its rise, its popularity, and its persistent appeal, nor the diversity of views that are expressed by its leaders, members, and supporters. So in this presentation, we consider the ways in which Mabatha has emerged partly in response to persistent concerns regarding the inherent limitations on the central Buddhist authority in Myanmar. This is the State Sangha Mahanayaka Committee, or Mahana in its Burmese acronym. We'll talk a little bit about the formation of that group, but just to be aware, for people not familiar with this discourse, Mahana is the central Buddhist authority. Mabatha is this quote-unquote Buddhist nationalist organization. You might hear us get a little tongue-tied as well when we go through that. So Mabatha has been a vehicle for strengthening Buddhist political advocacy in an uncertain time of transition and championing a more engaged model of the monastic vocation in collaboration with the laity. While Mabatha's leaders present their organization as complementary to Mahana, growing tensions between the two seem to hint at a looming contestation over Buddhist authority and representation. In one sense, Mabatha is a product of a particular period of time, this transitional moment of uncertainty where the opening up of political space has taken place alongside a broader opening up of Myanmar more generally. And this has coincided with a global rhetorical and political legal period of anti-Islamic sentiment that's ranged from skepticism to outright hostility towards Muslims across the globe. However, while this constellation of enabling factors related to Mabatha's emergence might be specific to a present moment in Myanmar, I think we want to see its rise also as just the most recent occurrence of a more regular phenomenon, of the contestation of and between spiritual, moral, and political authority in Myanmar and in Theravada Buddhist majority countries as a whole. And that is to say, Mabatha and its members and supporters are partly motivated by the current context of concern over the perceived spread of Islam, as well as questions about the place for religious pluralism in a contemporary Burmese society. But they're also involved in a process of negotiating and reinterpreting monastic identities, one that's been ongoing since the founding of the Sangha, but is shaped by the kind of particular debates of different eras. What this means is that Mabatha monks have put forward arguments that are both implicit and explicit that are related to monastic activities and obligations. And in the process, they've engaged with broader questions of intra-Sangha authority structures and state-Sangha relations. Our analysis of Mabatha, and by extension this broader quote-unquote Buddhist nationalist movement, in relation to sort of formal religious and political authority, further reinforces a point that we and lots of other scholars in Burmese studies have sought to emphasize, which is that religious authority and identity in Myanmar is diffuse and continually contested and renegotiated. And this is revealed in very visible moments of structural change, such as the creation of the State Sangha Mahanayaka Committee in the 1980s, as well as in the day-to-day interactions that constitute intra-Sangha and state-Sangha relations. So we should see the monkhood as an institution whose centralization is never complete, even in those moments where religious authority seems to be most apparent. And it's during these moments of contestation that are conceived both broadly and in terms of very localized debates or disputes that we can see the outlines of categories and concepts that we use in our analysis come into sharper relief. We're not going to talk about it as much in today's paper. Happy to discuss it a bit more in the Q&A. But we see this particular period of struggle over religious authority and the relationship between religious and political authorities as an example of what Ananda Abhisekara calls contingent conjunctures. These are periods where, quote, competing narratives and debates conjoin and converge to make centrally visible particular authoritative knowledges about what can and cannot count as Buddhism. And what we're also looking at here and trying to understand the dynamics of Mabatha's emergence as a particular debate over monastic vocations and the idea of the monkhood in a kind of Buddhist society. We argue that the emergence and persistent popularity of Mabatha can be understood through the way that the group provides an outlet for channeling critiques of and concerns related to Mahana, the central Buddhist authority. Broader insecurities about the place, status, and durability of Buddhism in Myanmar today are focused via this discourse on inadequacies in Sangha governance, in monastic governments, especially the way in which Mahana is seen as a kind of outdated model that was part of the military authoritarian period, and also a real or perceived decline in respect for monastic moral authority. While the criticisms of Mahana in the present period appear to be consistent with those that were expressed in past decades, they get refracted through this present moment of a perceived crisis of Buddhism, which is occurring in the context of the expansion of political space in Myanmar and these dynamics of globalization more broadly. Mabatha has provided an effective vehicle for carrying out activities seen as outside the scope of Mahana's remit and encouraging reform of monastic governance, while also expanding the existing institutional networks through which monks can conduct their religious, social, and sometimes political activities. So at the same time, the limits of these critiques and calls for reform come into clearer resolution when we examine the language that monks have used in criticizing Sangha authority. It's highly depersonalized, as we'll see, with arguments that are put forward in a way that preserves the necessary moral authority of Mahana in the abstract, while promoting reform and even strengthening the ability of the monastic governing body to advocate on behalf of both monks and Buddhism more generally. The two public rebukes that Mahana gave to Mabatha in 2016 and 2017 also indicate potential fracture points between the two organizations, whose goals are in fact quite similar. And those moments of tension reveal the limits of critiques and attempts at reform that are launched from outside of the formal monastic governance structure. So many of you are probably somewhat familiar with Mabatha, having been in the news quite a bit for the last 4 or 5 years, but you might not know as much about Mahana, the formal monastic authority. So we're not going to go into the long history of state-sangha relations here, but we're just going to start with the formation of the Congregation of the Sangha of All Orders for Purification, Perpetuation, and Propagation of the Sasana, or the Buddhist religion, which was this organization that was set up under government auspices in Myanmar, in Burma, in April 1980. And this was the moment when a much more centralized structure for the monkhood began to emerge. They gradually incorporated diverse sects and parts of the Sangha hierarchy into one single body, over which the government exercised substantial influence, chiefly through appointing the members of Mahana, the 47-member council that kind of sits at the top of the entire hierarchy. This process culminated in October 1990, when the military regime created the Law Concerning Sangha Organizations that was for the governance of the whole Sangha community, thereby granting authority to the formal governing body, Mahana, for all Sangha affairs in Myanmar. Now, successive governments have controlled or influenced Mahana in various ways over time, and at the same time, Mahana's agenda has also, I think it's fair to say, been more closely aligned with the governments, not necessarily with the broader monastic community, if we could even say that the broader monastic community has an agenda. And since its founding, Mahana and its state-level counterparts have given directives related to Buddhism and Buddhist organizations and the governance of the monkhood. They've ruled on cases involving monks, and they've also issued decisions on allegedly heretical or deviant interpretations of Buddhism. As we think about the institutional arrangements through which state Sangha relations are governed, it's important that we're attentive to a kind of inherently imbalanced power dynamic, right? And that is, the Sangha, the monkhood, is one of the three jewels of Buddhism, the three gems, alongside the Buddha and the Dhamma, his teachings. So the Sangha occupies one of the highest rungs on the sort of moral ladder. And many, if not most, members of the Sangha consider regulation of monastic conduct by any kind of lay authority to be anathema, and particularly unbecoming of a government in a Buddhist majority society. Those kinds of relationships between state and Sangha are then inevitably kind of existing in this sort of fluctuating equilibrium over time, where in one period one institution exercises a stronger influence on the other and vice versa. In recent centuries in the Theravada world, I think in most cases the dominant party seems to have been the political authority, although there are some exceptions to this. And it's important for us to remember that the creation of Mahana in the 1980s took place during a period where there seemed to be more support, especially within the Sangha, for stronger political regulation of the monkhood, and for stronger kind of advocacy on behalf of Buddhism. By contrast, recent events in Myanmar can be construed as demonstrating that the Sangha, at least represented by Mabatha, has capitalized on its newfound political space to renegotiate the terms of that equilibrium, that religious-political equilibrium, in its favor. So, kind of laid out this broad argument, and in a moment I'm going to turn this over to Ma to give an analysis of the kind of the critiques of Mahana, the religious authority that emerged from our research. But just to give you a little bit of the broader context that we'll come back to, this paper is part of a much wider project that's funded by the ESRC, the Economic and Social Research Council of the UK, that's entitled Understanding, quote, Buddhist Nationalism in Myanmar, Religion, Gender, Identity, and Conflict in a Political Transition. And our research team has been conducting interviews in areas across Myanmar since the end of 2016. These are usually semi-structured interviews with sets of overlapping questions designed to elicit information on a wide range of topics that are related to different prongs of the research. And this idea of the tensions between Mabatha and Mahana, or the kind of shifting dynamics between them, have gradually emerged over the course of the last year and a half as an important aspect in further disaggregating this sort of quote-unquote Buddhist nationalist movement. So in addition to being happy to get some feedback on this particular part, we'll say a few things about the broader framing, and so really happy to get comments on the framing and analysis and the kinds of conclusions that we're drawing.
In my section, when we are in the field work, one thing we focused on was gossip, the gossip of monks to monks, right? And so basically, mostly Mabatha and some lower rank of Mahana criticizing Mahana behind the back. So so that's the section that we focus on it. Mahana is often seen as an old, out of touch group of monks, far from reality and not expressing sufficient concern for the welfare of their Dakar Dagama, donors or supporters. One of the most persistent and pernicious criticism of Mahana is corruption. These type of comments range from more mild statements that senior Mahana monks are too comfortable in their position and influenced by having received titles and other form of honors and privilege, to more direct accusation of receiving bribes. Sometimes this concern is expressed in Buddhism. Mahana monks with all of their material comforts have forgotten the necessary elements of dukkha, suffering, and anicca, impermanence, in their Buddhist practice. Often, this critic is connected a perception that Mahana is not meaningfully independent of the government. Xuezi Di Sayaro, who runs one of the biggest monastic schools in Sitwe in Rakhine State, believes that, I quote, the government has got those old monks in their pocket, unquote. It is Mahana position under the government control that frustrated many of the monks who spoke with. One state, I quote, I do acknowledge that Mahana was formed out of necessity. And as such, I don't question the reason for its existence. What I find problematic, however, is that it's an organization that pretty much walks in the path laid out by the government. I don't feel that Mahana Sayados have come to the defense of Bada and Tadana. In that case, both Bada and Tadana can be interpreted as Buddhist religion in crucial movement. Similarly, another monk told us, I quote, under normal circumstances, it is good to have an organization like Mahana. However, it should not exist as it currently does, in a position of subordination whereby they only do government's bidding. Many monks encounter Mahana only in its regulatory capacity, and even then, their interactions would take place largely at arm's length and only sporadically. Mahana rules monastic life from a distance. Its dominant administrative mechanism becoming active when serious problems such as dispute over ownership of monastic property arise. Otherwise, the interactions between local monastery and abbot and different level of Mahana authority remain at a bare minimum. As a result, the central organization only seems to appear in monks' life when it is interfering in their affair. Consistently throughout the interviews, monks defended a need for a central monastic authority, but one that focused more on advocating up to the government on behalf of monks and less on controlling the monks below it. In other words, many monks see quite content with the current status quo of minimum supervision, and they want downwards delegation of monastic authority. At the same time, there appears to be relatively widespread concern among other monks, and that's why it seems to be more prevalent among senior monks regarding the regulation of monastic conduct in general. Mahana is supposed to undertake the purification duty, and it seems as not consistently carry out this duty. It should be noted that this is often a self-interest critic, in that monks strongly believe that the other monks should be disciplined and held to the Vinaya most strictly, but see this regulation of their own conduct and activities as unjust, unjustified interference. Many monks wanted a monastic hierarchy that was not only independent of the government, but could act as a strong advocate for monastic interest and for the Buddhism more generally, why this was not necessarily the reasoning behind the creation of Mahana and the monastic bureaucracy. More about what we'll talk later. It partly reflects the changing attitude of how monks and monastic organizations should behave. Why direct monastic engagement in politics is still a controversial topic. The idea of senior, respected monks acting as moral advisors to government leaders and ministries seem to have more appeal. Advocating on behalf of Buddhism more broadly would not only include engaging with the government, but taking a more active role in encouraging, managing, and supporting activities that strengthen the religion, such as prahita, social work, and tadanapu work, building up the religion through the construction of religious edifice, implementing Buddhist education, or providing materials support to monk. Many of our interviews brought that Mahana was not active enough in this area. Some of these critics can be expressed broadly as frustration that Mahana is not or cannot effectively carry out the duties that it does currently have. For example, the monastic authority is supposed to resolve disputes between monks related to lands, titles, and other matters. However, there are many complaints that Mahana is not solving this problem, and that is that the bureaucratic structure creates opportunities for corruption partially. It's slightly more controversial and certainly not universal. Critically relates to the structure and decision-making process of Mahana. Some groups of monks have long advocated for more democratic reforms within the Sangha hierarchy and bureaucracy. They argue that changes norm within society should be reflected within the monkhood, and that more democratic processes would be a reform that would enable other reforms as monks gain more of a voice in Mahana. Now, I'd like to hand over the presentation to Aiting.
Thanks, Dr. Ma, for your part talking about the critiques of Mahana in general. Now, I would like to continue with our sort of initial analysis of these critiques. First of all, we should know that these critiques actually contradict each other. For example, allegations of corruption or getting too comfortable in official positions are refuted by some assertions from some of our monks that Mahana monks represent the pinnacle of moral discipline, which is itself the foundation of the critique that Mahana cannot inherently be more involved in mundane political or social affairs. And similarly, a concern that Mahana ought to largely leave monks to govern their own affairs, only intervening in serious cases, sits uncomfortably alongside worries about a general decline in monastic discipline and the need to impose order. And not all of these critiques that we have presented are made by Mabada-affiliated monks only. Part of the next stage of our research is to determine whether particular critiques or concerns are more commonly expressed by Mabada-affiliated monks. But what's important for our purposes here is that this broad set of concerns creates an environment in which a group like Mabada is potentially seen as a necessary complement to Mahana, but sits in an uncertain relationship to formal Buddhist authority. So one relevant aspect of all of these critiques is that none of the broad categories are new. The same concerns were articulated during and after the 2007 so-called Separate Revolution protest, and were also present in the years surrounding the 1988 protest, when Mahana was still in the process of being officially constituted. So our interest is in the ways in which certain critiques gain strength or renewed salience as they're re-articulated in the present socio-political context. There's also another important aspect to note, which is the language in which these critiques are expressed reveals some of the dynamics that underpin intra-Sangha relations as well as inter-Sangha organizations. We see that even the softest form of censure is made, I think Matt has alluded to this earlier, it's made in such a way that it is carefully depersonalized. For example, in our interviews, no monk went anywhere near naming a particular figure within the Mahana senior leadership, although they are all extremely critical of the organization itself. Respect for seniority within the Sangha is a well-documented fact of life, so it hardly warrants further comment. However, this norm and the actual practice takes on a new level of salience in the context of the teacher-pupil relationship. Monks hold, like generally speaking, in the highest regard the teacher under whose tutelage they study, and those who officiated their entry into the Sangha. Given this norm surrounding the pupil-teacher relationship, we would be hard-pressed to find a situation where a pupil would publicly criticize his teacher. So perhaps this could provide part of the explanation as to why those who are highly critical of Mahana as an organization still express their respect and gratitude to a state-level Mahana monk who arguably represents the most visible face of Mahana at township and state levels. So at some point during their learning career, they all would have been his pupil. Furthermore, what might be called the networks within networks in the Sangha seem to be considerably denser than those we find, for example, in the civil society sector. These networks are conducive to building close connections between monks of different political persuasions and monasteries from different locations. So in this sense, although we saw earlier to emphasize the point that the Sangha is a diverse and diffuse organization, containing many different and sometimes contradictory perspectives, it can also appear as a strongly unitary in certain respects. So recognizing this dynamic is crucial in understanding why it might be challenging for monks to critically distance themselves from other monks or monastic groups that they might disagree with, whether Mahana or Mabada. So the responses in our interviews, which vary in terms of the severity of criticisms leveled against Mahana, can be interpreted as the different ways in which the authority of the organization is contested from both Mabada and individual members of the Sangha. So, however, when we say that Mahana's authority is being contested, it is not its religious authority that is being questioned. Rather, it is the group's political authority or lack thereof on which the criticisms are focused. So as scholars have pointed out, you know, putting the Sangha state or Sangha society relations in Myanmar in the rigid sort of secular religious framework is not very helpful in understanding how those relations work in the messy world of real life. For instance, many of our interviewees refuse to accept that the decisions officially taken by Mahana, that is Mahana as the foremost religious authority in the country, could be considered religious in the strict sense of the term, largely because Mahana is seen as being a tool of the political authorities. It's also worth considering the ways in which this relationship, which can seem competitive and antagonistic from an outside perspective, might actually be mutually beneficial for both groups. And following on from the criticism above about the ineffectiveness of Mahana in carrying out expected duties, there's a sense in some of our interviews that both groups need each other. Senior monks within Mahana might be restricted in the available actions they could take because of the perceived dependence of Mahana on the government, the sluggish pace of the monastic bureaucracy, or because the dictates of the Vinaya, while ideally providing a code of conduct for all monks, might weigh more heavily on more senior and respectable monks. So for example, Mabada as a Sangha lay organization might be in a better position to respond to perceived emergencies, be they communal violence or natural disasters. Now, of course, the other side of this is that Mabada and monks more generally would expect that Mahana would be effective in its areas of competency, such as advocating for monks and maintaining discipline within the Sangha. Lastly, the other intriguing comparative aspect is that is just emerging in our research, is the potential tripartite comparison of relationships between Mahana, Mabada, and what might be called the Saffron monks, those who participated in the 2007 Saffron Revolution. While some of those monks are today affiliated with Mabada, others have adopted a more critical position that aligns partly with Mahana concerns regarding Mabada's actions as potentially harming the positive public image of Buddhism. So there seems to be a significant overlap between the critiques of Mahana made by the Saffron monks in 2007 and Mabada in recent years. But opening up the analysis in this way complicates the picture and also seems to lend credence to the concerns about political fractures within the Sangha. So that's so much for our initial analysis of the critics, and I'll hand it over to Matt again. Thanks.
So how does this help us understand Mabatha and this current moment of quote-unquote Buddhist nationalism? And first of all, these intra-sangha tensions, these intra-monastic tensions, are rarely discussed in any analysis of Mabatha. That analysis usually focuses on the kind of anti-Muslim components of it. And I'll say, we haven't focused on that today. If you're familiar with any of our work, we write about that a lot. We talk about that a lot. We're certainly, in presenting what we're presenting today, we're certainly not trying to downplay or dismiss the anti-Muslim components of Mabatha's program and its rhetoric and its activities. But it's always been the argument of this project that needs to be contextualized if we're going to understand this phenomenon, and also in terms of various policy-oriented responses to dealing with the kind of violence in Myanmar. So highlighting these things we think is important. Also, the fact that Mabatha emerged during the previous military-aligned political administration means that most analysis of the group, including a lot of the stuff that many of us would have been writing several years ago, highlighted government support for the organization, especially in the context of the 2015 election, because that was the empirical relationship at that moment. But a more contentious relationship that's developed recently between Mabatha and the current National League for Democracy government has brought these critiques of Mahana back to the surface, reminding us that both religious and political authorities try to influence the other, exercise some control over the other's realms. And we need to understand these dynamics to get a better sense of what Mabatha is as an organization, as a movement, as a kind of framing device, how it's been evolving in recent years, along with political changes in Myanmar, and where the potential fracture points are, both within the organization, within the Sangha more broadly, and in this kind of state Sangha or Sangha society relationship. Mabatha was not intended as a direct challenge to religious authorities in Myanmar. Both Mabatha and Mahana monks have seen Mabatha as complementary to Mahana in many ways, as we've tried to present today. So in 2016 and 2017, Mahana issued public orders that were critical of Mabatha. So the first in 2016, well, both were widely interpreted as bans on the organization. And I'll explain in a moment why they weren't. But so in both of those moments when Mahana issued those orders, although there was some grumbling from some of the most vocal Mabatha monks, Mabatha's monastic leadership immediately and publicly accepted the decisions and accepted the authority of Mahana there. I've written several pieces. We've also written some things that have contextualized those critical orders, arguing that they were carefully crafted by Mahana, by the Buddhist authority, to avoid criticizing Mabatha's broader goals, and instead focused more on preserving the prestige of Mahana as that authority and also protecting the public image of Buddhism. Again, we should also note this dynamic that Athane mentioned, where there's a prominent discourse that questions whether those orders and those kind of politicized things that come from Mahana genuinely came from Mahana, or were done at the insistence of the NLD government. At no point has Mahana outlawed Mabatha. And indeed, the argument that we're making here and that a lot of our informants have made to us, that it occupies religio-political space that Mahana cannot act in, remains a salient reason why a group like Mabatha would continue to enjoy support. The recent arrival of Mabatha on the religio-political scene in Myanmar complicates what was already a relatively fractured religious landscape and fractured political landscape. We haven't talked in today's...
When did Mabatha begin?
So it was formed officially at the end of 2013. Kind of comes into more sort of popular profile by the beginning of 2014. Sorry, we tried to figure out sort of what we needed in terms of background for this, but happy to answer any other kind of questions like that. We haven't talked today in our talk about how ethnicity or other identity components map onto and overlay support for Mabatha, specifically these Mabatha Mahana dynamics and things like that. That's part of our broader project. We can discuss it in the Q&A, but it's worth noting here, I think, as part of our broader framing, that both the quote-unquote Buddhist and quote-unquote nationalism parts of quote-unquote Buddhist nationalism need to be disaggregated in the Myanmar context, and that's really what we're trying to do here. And again, we can elaborate on that a bit. But where we want to end up today is saying that one thing that this points to is that we need to adopt a much broader lens for analyzing and understanding Mabatha and this broader movement. Not only is anti-Muslim sentiment just one part of what the movement espouses, these intra-sangha dynamics that we're talking about are also only a part of the picture. And tentatively, what we want to suggest is that Mabatha's platform is, more broadly, the creation of ideal Buddhist subjects in a holistic and relatively conservative, although kind of contested, fashion. The activities of the organization touch on many aspects of people's daily lives, from individual moral practice to education, to donation and other religious practices, to grassroots empowerment of Buddhists, to political and economic activities. Now, can we say that this broader platform is coherent, clearly articulated by particular agents within Mabatha? I think the answer to that question is unclear. There are some spokespeople who connect some of these diverse elements into a broader set of religio-political aims, but part of Mabatha's persistent appeal has been the fact that it seems to be everything to everybody. We've described this dynamic in the past in our writings as a need for those of us studying Mabatha and this movement to recognize that people in Myanmar often encounter Mabatha as a pro-Buddhist organization rather than an anti-Muslim one. It supports education, strengthening Buddhist practice, all of those things. Saying it in that way, I think, is an important corrective to what you usually see as part of the analysis, but it still doesn't adequately describe what we're coming to see, essentially, as, in effect, a much more totalizing reach of the organization. That's part of the broader sort of direction in which this project is moving. I think we'll kind of end there and invite questions, comments, discussion on the particular sort of
feedback
part of the talk today and on the broader framing. Thanks very much.